This is Movies for the Blind, Episode 26, The Last Man on Earth, Part 1.
Another day to start all over again.
Hello and welcome to Movies for the Blind, where you can enjoy films without looking at a screen. I'm Valerie Hunter. Now, in case you've gotten the idea from this podcast that I'm some great expert about movies, here's a case to prove you wrong. As you may know, Charlton Heston passed away recently, and it got me thinking about describing a movie I thought he was in, which is one of the most popular downloads on the Internet Archive. But Heston starred in another movie, The Omega Man, in 1971, which, like a film starring Will Smith late in 2007, was based on Richard Matheson's science fiction novel, I Am Legend, about a man standing alone after a plague wipes out the population. Sort of. The movie I found on the Internet Archive was the original adaptation, starring Vincent Price. Frankly, it's a mistake I'm glad I made. From 1964, this is The Last Man on Earth. The sun rises on a small city. The collection of plain buildings of various sizes is surrounded by gently rolling hills. The sun's heat starts to develop a haze. A block of apartment buildings seems completely void of people. The boulevard is empty except for a few cars parked on the side. Strips of wood lay among young spare trees in a park. The sky is as empty as any other public place. But two bodies lie on the ground in a plaza. Another lies in a lot. A couple more on the edge of a construction site, and two more within it. Another is curled up in a doorway. Three others on a wide flight of stairs, and more on sidewalks and streets. Others lie on the steps to a church, where a sign reads, "The end has come." On a shady residential street, in one of the modest houses, a man lies in bed, eyes closed. An alarm clock sits on an end table beside him. The man wakes, turning to the alarm clock. He shuts it off. He yawns and stretches and thinks to himself.
Another day to live through. Better get started.
He gets to his feet and staggers out of the bedroom. American International Pictures. The Last Man on Earth. Starring Vincent Price. The man walks into the kitchen, co-starring Franca Bedoya, Emma Danielli, Giacomo Rossi-Stewart, with Umberto Rao, Christy Cortland, Tony Correvi, Hector Ribota. The man looks at a calendar.
December 1965. Is that all it has been since I inherited the world? Only 3 years. Seems like 100 million.
Hand-drawn calendars are marked with X's through 1968. Director of photography, Franco Delicoli. The man marks a fourth X in September. Film editor, Gene Ruggiero. Production manager, Vico Vaccaro. Assistant director, Carlo Grandone. Removing a bar from the kitchen door, the man steps out to check a wreath of garlic hanging from the door. Music composed by Paul Sawtelle and Bert Schefter. Screenplay by Logan Swanson and William F. Lechester. From the novel, I Am Legend by Richard Matheson. Produced by Robert L. Lippert. Associate producer, Harold E. Knox. Directed by Sidney Salkow. The man walks around the back of his house, checking windows. Then approaches a garage. Unlocking the door, he steps inside. As he tucks his white T-shirt into his slacks, he steps past a car to a covered generator engine. He removes a small cap and checks the oil level, then replaces the cap. Taking the cover off the engine, He glances at it and removes the gas cap beside it. He places a funnel in the hole to the tank, picks up a fuel can, and pours in some fuel through the funnel. Setting down the fuel can, he takes out the funnel, replaces the cap securely, and covers the engine again. He starts tucking his dress shirt into his slacks as he steps around the car, a station wagon, to the garage doors, which have also been barred closed. He pulls away the bar and sets it aside, then opens the doors to find a body in front of them.
An empty, dead, silent world.
He kicks the body over, revealing a pale, diseased male corpse. Unfazed, he walks down the driveway to another one, a female covered with fallen leaves.
More of them for the pit. Every day there are more of them. They live off the weak ones and leave them for the pit.
With a glance around his front walk, he goes back to the kitchen door and pulls a shard from a broken mirror under the garlic. Then returns to the kitchen. Shoulders slumped, he steps to a coffee pot and finds it hot. So he unplugs it and takes it with a cup across the kitchen and out into the living room, which is a little more disheveled than he is. He pours himself a cup of coffee as he walks and takes a sip. He sets the pot on top of a large radio receiver, then sets down his cup on a table full of empty bottles and sits. He switches on the radio and picks up a microphone.
KOKW calling. Come in.
He turns a switch to receive. Sipping his coffee, he switches again to transmit.
KOKW calling. I'm on international frequency. Come in.
Again, he tries to receive something. Matter-of-factly, he sips his coffee again and turns off the radio. Standing, he grabs his coffee pot and pours another cup as he crosses the living room to the front door, then sets them down. He removes a bar from inside the door so he can open it. Glancing around, he checks the garlic wreath hanging from that door under another broken mirror.
They can't bear to see their image. It repels them. I need more mirrors. And this garlic's lost its pungency.
He throws it away and goes back inside. He takes the coffee past a dining table and into a storage room, where he checks his pantry.
There was a time when eating was pleasurable. Now it bores me. Just fuel for survival. I'll settle for coffee and orange juice this morning. But first, there's my life to consider. I'd better replace that garlic.
Setting aside a can of food, he opens a small door and pulls out a basket. He inspects the small garlic braid and head of garlic inside it.
I'll need more, lots more. Better stop off and get him.
He replaces the basket and closes the small door. Looking around the storage room, he notices some children's toys. He picks up a little doll and smiles. But the smile fades, and he puts the doll down. Picking up the can again, he throws it angrily. Then he leaves the storage room.
I can't afford the luxury of anger. Anger can make me vulnerable. It can destroy my reason, and reason's the only advantage I have over them. I've got to find where they hide during the day. Uncover every one of them.
He checks a map.
Now, where did I finish off yesterday? Madison Street to 31st Avenue. 11 kills. Over 3 years. And there's more than half the city I haven't searched.
He turns on a lathe, holding a small piece of wood. As it turns, he shaves it down so one end is fairly wide and the other is a sharp point. Turning turning off the lathe. He picks up the finished steak.
They're perfect. Just wide enough to keep the flesh apart so their body seal can't function.
He packs a bag with them.
And how many more of these will I have to make before they're all destroyed? They want my blood. Their lives are mine. But I still get squeamish.
Soon after, in a sweater and jacket, he carries the bag outside through the front door. Hefting a hammer in the other hand, he pauses.
Wait. That garlic.
He drops everything.
I'd better put it back where it belongs. I can't live a heartbeat away from hell. Forget it.
With the thrown garlic back on the door, he picks up the female corpse and carries it to the open back of his station wagon. He lays it inside. Then he gets the male corpse, dragging it to the car. He pushes it in beside the other one, leaving the rear doors open. The man gets behind the wheel of the station wagon. As he starts it, he notices the gas gauge.
I'm out of gas. That means one more stop I'll have to make.
He backs the station wagon out of the garage and up the driveway. Then he drives off. Later, he drives past bodies on the edge of the street.
I can get rid of them later. Right now, I'm out of gas.
A little further along, he pulls up to an abandoned fuel truck and stops beside it. He gets out of the station wagon. Approaching a collection of jerry cans, he takes one and climbs onto the truck. Later, with the station wagon refueled, he drives on away from the city. He stops on a dirt road and peers out at the skyline through a haze of smoke. He puts on a gas mask, then drives to the edge of the source of the smoke, a large quarry pit with flames reaching from the bottom. Getting out of the car, he steps to the back and pulls out the female corpse. He carries it in his arms to the edge of the pit and drops her to tumble down the side. He picks up one of another collection of jerry cans and pours gasoline down the pit, soon tossing the can itself down as well. He bends down to light a torch, then picks it up and throws it down. He steps away to continue his work. Soon after disposing of both corpses, he takes off the gas mask as he drives back to the city. Later, he parks at a curb in front of some abandoned cars. Getting out, he walks to a nearby supermarket, where a mess of shopping carts blocks the open doorway. He pushes past them and steps past the registers, passing shelves almost half full of items. He kicks away cans and boxes left in the aisle on his way to the barren meat counter. He walks around and behind the counter. Approaching a large generator, he studies it for any trouble. Satisfied, he checks something on a nearby wall, reaching up to make adjustments. He rubs his hands together, warming them up after touching something cold. then glances at the generator once more and walks a short distance in the other direction to a door. Opening it, he steps into the meat locker and past the hanging carcasses, aged or used up to the point of being unrecognizable. He inspects baskets of garlic, smelling one.
It's still fresh, but I'll take only what I need. They've got to last.
Putting a few handfuls on top of one full basket, he picks it up and carries it back to the car. He drops it in the still open back of the station wagon and returns to the driver's seat. He drives away, speeding down a street. He goes past and over debris and more bodies.
They can wait, too. I've got my life to worry about. Those mirrors have to be replaced before dark.
Later, with the car parked outside a mirror shop, the man looks around intently. He picks up a couple portrait-sized framed mirrors, then another as he turns to look for more. He picks up more. Three of them. Then he takes one more before he leaves. Back on the road.
Square blocks to search. How many of them still exist? How long will I have to keep up this search?
After parking again, he smashes a door window to break into an abandoned building. He carries his bag of wooden stakes inside. Then he opens a door on a woman curled up on a cot. She recoils at the light with her pale, diseased skin and sunken eyes. Then he hammers a stake into her. Later, he checks a notebook as he drives around the city, searching for more vampires to kill. He finds the odd one sleeping away from the light in various places. He stalks them in their weakened state and kills them with his stakes. Then he returns to the pit to dispose of them. The day wears on as the man methodically hunts down vampires and keeps track of them in his notebook. He searches an amusement park. In a shadowy storage area, he finds a sleeping vampire in a burlap blanket and kills it.
I haven't much time left. It'll be dark in an hour.
He hurries back down his street and pulls into his driveway, parking in the garage. In the kitchen, he finishes braiding the new garlic into reeds and takes one of them to the kitchen door, which he opens, tossing the old garlic away for good. He hangs up the new garlic, closes the door, and bars it again from the inside. He picks up another wreath, which soon hangs on the front door with a couple crosses and one of the new mirrors. His day's work done, he rubs his sore hands as he wanders through the house.
Now, 12 long hours before the sun will rise and drive them back to darkness.
Throwing some garbage out of the way, he picks up a stack of albums and opens a record changer console. He places the albums inside on the spindle, and the first one drops onto the turntable. Outside, a vampire waves a plank of wood. Zombie-like, he staggers slowly toward the house, followed by others like him. Aware, the man crosses the living room while the vampires stagger closer with their pieces of wood. As the man picks up a bottle, the lead vampire swings at a boarded-up window.
Morgan! Come out! Come out!
Morgan looks out at the vampire and throws an empty bottle at him in anger, then keeps trying to open the full bottle of liquor. Paces to a couch.
Come out. Come out.
He He sits down with the bottle, still trying to open it, but finally tosses it aside and puts his feet up. His fear dampened by time and simple annoyance. Morgan listens to his music and the vampires incessantly banging on his house. Well after the last album has been played, Morgan dozes on the couch, his arms jerking in a dream. He sits up in terror, then looks around and realizes that it's morning. He stands and steps to the boarded-up window.
Another day. Another day to start all over again.
Shaking his head, he runs a hand through his hair as he crosses the living room, then notices all the lights are still on. He goes to a switch and turns them off. Wearily, he walks over to the record changer and stops the turntable. Then he closes the lid and turns off the console. On the wall above it, he peers at his map of the city and makes a note in his book. As he slips the book in his jacket pocket, he approaches the lathe. He picks up a stake for a moment, then takes a block of wood from a pile and loads it into the lathe. He starts it turning, but the noise makes him shake his head with pain and frustration. He throws down his shaping tool and shuts off the machine. He hurries away. Soon after, he drives down a highway, taking a street, he turns onto another lined with trees and a cemetery beyond them. He stops beside some piles of white rubble and scaffolding. Getting out of the car, he walks quickly around a building to where a cross towers over him. He climbs a few stairs to approach a modern white church. Using a key, he lets himself inside. Soon after, he lights tall, thin candles on an altar. Blowing out a match, he turns away from the altar and approaches a white sarcophagus. Gazing at it, he walks around it. Then he sits beside it on its platform.
Birds. Birds. God, how I miss you.
He keeps gazing down sadly at the sarcophagus, lost in his thoughts. Then he begins to weep. When all the candles have burned down, Morgan is dozing with an arm draped over the sarcophagus. He slowly wakes, then checks his watch. He looks out through the doors.
The sun's already set. They'll be everywhere.
He hurries out of the church, closing the front doors without locking them. As he rushes for his car, two vampires wait for him. They lunge, but Morgan easily shoves them aside and runs on. Rushing through the cemetery, he pauses when he finds several vampires rummaging around the ruins in his path. He goes in among them and fights them off one by one. A vampire almost gets hold of Morgan's neck, but is pushed away. With the vampires lurking, Morgan makes it into his car and speeds off. The rear door is closed. He glances back to check as he drives on. As the vampires from last night return to his home with their pieces of wood, Morgan races to meet them. The lead vampire beats on the front door and sees Morgan arrive.
It's Morgan! Get in!
He stops in the driveway as they converge. He backs up onto the road again and is able to run a couple of them down. Pulling into the driveway again, he backs onto a curb as the vampires crowd around the car. Morgan opens the driver's door and gets out into the clutches of three vampires, but he shoves them down. He grabs a mirror, and when the lead vampire approaches, he holds it up to him, forcing him to turn away. Morgan keeps it up, backing the lead vampire toward the front door, then gets past him as he opens it. Another vampire gets inside. When he's shoved out, another reaches in but gets his arm closed in the door. Morgan slams it. Then he closes it completely so he can bar it again. The vampires slowly beat at the door. Catching his breath, Morgan walks away. He picks up his radio microphone, then drops it in disgust, and puts a cigarette in his mouth. The vampires spread out to beat on the windows and walls. Later that night, smoking and holding a glass of liquor, Morgan sits beside a small projector and stares at home movies. They show a pretty woman holding a baby, smiling and talking to it, then kissing its tiny head. Morgan smokes as he watches the woman with her daughter, now a little girl, and a man who looks like the lead vampire. The girl blows out candles on a cake at a birthday party with her mother at her side. She helps the girl cut the cake. Morgan keeps watching as the scene changes to a circus with mother and daughter laughing in the audience. Dressed up monkeys play music, and clowns blow smoke through instruments, fighting playfully as mother and daughter laugh, beaming. Exhausted, Morgan grins and starts to laugh. Watching a donkey kick a man, he brightens some more. Then he starts to sob.
Morgan! Do you hear, Morgan?
Disgusted and despairing, Morgan. He gets off the couch. As the vampires keep beating on his front door, Morgan wrings his hands.
Three years.
He remembers a time when he shot some of those home movies, peering through his small camera at the birthday party, where the little girl counts candles.
Hey, Verge.
Yes?
He films the mother.
My makeup. My hair.
Hey, where is everybody? All I can
see. Hi, Ben.
A man arrives carrying a stack of gift boxes.
Uncle Ben!
The little girl runs up to him.
Hey, look at how I'm
And he scoops her up.
Ben, Uncle Ben, Uncle Ben!
Smiling, Morgan films Kathy with Ben, the man who would become the lead vampire.
Where'd you bring me?
Open him and see.
Come.
The other kids gather around. Later, as the kids play in the festively decorated yard, Morgan drops a newspaper clipping on the patio table where Ben sits and picks up an open gift box to put aside.
Take a look at this.
Ben hands him another clipping, which Morgan unfolds and reads. The headline, Plague Claims Hundreds, is Europe's Disease Carried on the Wind.
It's highly theoretical, Ben.
Theoretical? Do I have to remind you that theory is the beginning of solution?
Verge takes the clipping from Morgan and looks through it.
Is Europe's disease carried on the wind? Is it, Ben?
Could be.
And if it is?
It isn't, Verge.
Is that what you really think, or just what you'd like to think?
I cannot accept half-baked theories that sell newspapers. I'm a scientist, not an alarmist.
You're whistling past the graveyard.
Is that a commentary on my work at the lab?
We both know how hard you've worked.
I'm sorry, Ben. I just can't accept the idea of universal disease.
Kathy runs up.
Uncle Ben, you promised your conscience.
All right, Kathy. Who can resist that face? All right. Card tricks.
As Ben carries Kathy back to her friends.
Robert.
Verge sits at the table.
Is it possible this germ or virus could be airborne?
Anything is possible, Verge. The best brains in the world have been running through this thing with a fine-tooth comb. The germ is visible under a microscope, but it's not like any bacilli I ever known.
In what way?
It can't be destroyed by any process we've been able to uncover.
But with the whole world trying, there must be a solution.
Hey,
she turns to Kathy.
Hey, Mommy, when are you going to cut the cake?
Right now, our problem is to cut that cake.
She stands. Robert pulls her toward him.
Hey, Mommy!
She kisses him.
Coming.
Then goes to her daughter. Robert looks at the clipping again. Sometime later, the yard is abandoned and windblown. In the house, Robert looks out a window. He closes the curtains and turns to Kathy in her bed, which is covered with a tent of netting. Adjusting the netting so it doesn't touch her, he sets a toy on top of one end on a stool to help secure it. Then he steps to the other side of the bed, looking down at her as she sleeps fitfully. Shaking his head, he leaves. He walks down the hall to another room and enters. In the bedroom, he does up his tie. Verge sits up in bed.
The wind wake you up?
It always does.
How do you feel?
She gets out of bed.
I'm all right.
Oh, don't get up, honey.
I'm not sick, Bob. I'll make
you don't have to.
I'll be all right. Go on and read your paper.
All right.
Smiling nervously, he turns away to pick up a jacket as she slips on a dressing gown. When he leaves, she leans on a chair in pain. She looks out a window at the wind. Out in the hall, wearing the jacket, Robert decides to check in on Kathy once more. He enters her room and looks at her half asleep, suffering, rubbing her eyes. As he turns to go, Verge walks in.
Oh, sweetheart, look, if you don't feel well, please go back to bed.
I'm just a little tired, that's all.
She goes to Kathy's side.
I wish somebody would find a vaccine.
It's all we're working on at the lab, Verge. Maybe you better not send her to school today.
All right. You think you should go to work?
I have to.
Oh, Bob. Bob, I'm so frightened.
He holds her.
Everything's going to be all right, sweetheart.
He looks again at his daughter. Later, passed by other traffic, Robert slows the station wagon when he approaches a large building. Parking in front of it, he gets out of the car. With his hands in his pockets, he strides toward the building, the Mercer Institute of Chemical Research. Later, in a lab inside, he looks through a microscope.
Well, the bacilli are multiplying.
That kicks the bone marrow theory in the head.
This specimen shows a higher white count than when I put it on the slide. Those cells are still living, Dr. Mercer, off one another.
There has to be an answer. You heard that all communications are ended outside the continental limits?
Yes, I heard.
That leaves it in our laps.
Nearby, Ben puts on a lab coat.
Where's Cortman?
Well, he should be here by now.
You two stay on this virus theory until I decide it's exhausted.
Right.
Dr. Mercer steps up to Ben.
Yes, sir.
Morgan will fill you in.
All right, sir.
Mercer leaves the busy lab.
And what did the great man of science have to say today? More of the usual?
Oh, he's trying, Ben, just like the rest of us.
And nothing works. The streets are swarming with truckloads of bodies that they're throwing into that god-awful pit. And the dedicated Dr. Mercer goes on with his plodding, unimaginative approach.
You have a better idea?
Maybe. At least it involves imagination.
Ben, it's as simple as this. An unknown germ is being blown around the world. It's highly contagious and it's reached plague proportions.
And you don't believe some of the dead have come back?
Now let's get to work.
And why are they burning the bodies? Why don't they bury them?
Because it's the best known way to control the contagion, to keep the germ from spreading.
That's what we've always believed, at any rate.
You'd prefer us to believe in vampires?
If they exist, yes. There are stories being told, Bob.
By people who are out of their minds with fear.
Maybe. But there are too many to be just coincidental. Stories about people who have died and have come back.
They're stories, Ben, stories.
And why are the infected people always so tired in the daytime? Why can't they stand the sunlight? Why are they only seen at night?
Come here.
Robert directs him to the microscope.
Look.
I know it's
look.
He does.
Now, is this bacilli or isn't it?
It doesn't alter.
And this bacilli is found in the blood of every infected person, or isn't it?
To show me germs is not to refute these stories, Bob. Point is, if there are vampires, they exist in spite of these germs.
Come on, let's get to work.
Ben complies, leaving Robert concerned. That night at home, Robert watches television.
And until further notice, this station will continue its around-the-clock coverage of this national disaster. And now, we switch you to the state capital, where His Excellency, the Governor, is speaking from the Executive Mansion.
Further, I have, in conjunction with the federal government, declared this state to be a disaster area. The public health is dependent on bodies of the deceased being burned.
You must notify the health department immediately.
If you have a plague victim in your home.
Robert stands.
Under no circumstances should you gather public. If you're the dire emergency that exists, I intend to...
When he shuts off the TV, Verge looks into the living room from the kitchen.
Anything new?
Huh? No, nothing new.
Nodding, she turns away. And Robert sits back on the couch with his coffee, sipping it thoughtfully.
Nothing.
Another day, as the wind blows leaves through the yard.
Mommy, where are you?
Kathy reaches out as Verge sits beside the bed.
Mommy, I can't see.
Robert sits on the other side. Verge stands.
I'm going to call the doctor.
I said no.
He walks around the bed to Verge and takes her hands.
Verge, there's nothing they can do.
Oh, we can't just let her lie there.
Well, this way she has a chance. If you call a doctor, he'll report it. Do you want that?
Considering the consequences, she sits in terror.
Mommy, help me. Mommy. Mommy, help me. How can you be so sure she...
Blindness is one of the symptoms. You're not to call a doctor under any circumstances. No one is to come into this house. Now remember that.
Mommy, where are you?
I've got to pick Ben Cortman up on the way to the lab. No one is to come into this house. Now remember that.
As she turns back to her daughter, Robert pats her hand and walks out. Kathy reaches out again, searching. Meanwhile, Robert opens the front door and watches a woman try to stop a group of soldiers from loading a body into the back of a truck. The truck pulls away.
Please, for God's sake, don't take a boy like this. You can't.
Soon after, Robert drives up to Ben's house. Getting out of the station wagon, he heads up his front walk, holding his hat on against the wind. Garlic and a mirror are hung on the door. Robert peers at them curiously. Then he presses the doorbell button and waits.
Who's there?
It's me, Ben. We're late.
The door opens and Ben steps out, scowling and not dressed for work.
Ben, what's the matter with you?
Nothing, and I'm going to keep it that way.
Ben, look, let's talk about this.
There's nothing to talk about. You think I'm out of my mind. You laughed at me and my theory. You might be one of them.
Ben, look, you're ill. You ought to see a doctor.
No doctors. You take care of your life, I'll take care of mine. Now get away from here. You understand? Get away from here!
Ben slams the door in his face. Robert drives on to work. He looks toward the siren, a police motorcycle coming toward him. He pulls over as the motorcycle stops, allowing for an army truck to pass, followed by another truck. The motorcycle follows them, and Robert continues on the way they came. Arriving at the Mercer Institute, he walks into the lab. No one is there. He steps through his work area, looking around, confused. Dr. Mercer enters the doorway and watches him.
If you're looking for anybody but me, forget it.
Robert approaches him.
Are they all gone?
That's right.
Is there any hope from the latest report?
No, not yet. But believe me, Morgan, we'll find an answer.
When, Doctor? We need it right now. I need it.
You're the only one who wasn't afraid to come here today.
What's going to happen, Dr. Mercer? Is everybody in the world going to die before someone finds the answer?
No, I don't think so. I don't deny there's some strange evolutionary process going on, but mankind won't be destroyed. The fact that you and I are working here today is evidence of that.
Mercer walks away. Of course, we have some idea that this flashback will not end well. But once it does end and we join Robert back in the present, then what? Can he possibly destroy all the vampires? Can there ever be a cure? Is he well and truly alone? And why isn't he infected anyway? All those questions will be answered next time on Movies for the Blind. For more information and links about the movies, about description, and how to subscribe, check out the blog, moviesfortheblind.com, where you can also find out about this podcast's Creative Commons license. The movies are from the Internet Archive, which is also the host for this podcast. So please support universal access to human knowledge by visiting and donating at www.archive.org. Thank you for downloading and for listening. Be back next week. Take care.